Good morning. This meeting of the House Special Committee on Fisheries will come to order. The time is 10:02 on Thursday, April 12th. We have Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Tarr, and myself, Chair Stutz. I'm going to ask that everybody make sure your cell phones are silenced. We're allowing the use of electronic devices during committee. We are asking that staff members of the and the audience not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get a hold of Matt Greening, my committee aide, and he would be happy to take care of it. I'd like to thank Brian Glynn of the Fisheries Committee Secretary and Doug Bridges from the Juno LIO for teleconferencing support. We also have Representative Newman, who has just joined us. I'd like to start off by clarifying that two of the documents in members' packets were not provided by not affiliated with the presentation. Those are the six-page document with the footnote Source National Habitat Partnership and the two-page document with the footnote Source Catherine Cassidy and Eric Hubisch, 2013. These documents are for our general discussion as well as the committee's and public's review. The reason I had the department prepare this presentation is a real concern in the fishing community. And the concern that they have with invasive pike in South Central Alaska and the devastating effect it's having on all salmonid populations and fishing opportunities. Although the presentation does not specifically focus on this species, one particular area of concern I want to cover in this committee discussion is the pike predation in the Susitna drainage on sockeye. This is a stock of yield concern and a non-human user, pike. It's playing a very large role in that. It seems that allowing for more escapement when we haven't adequately addressed the issue of pike devouring the smolt in the rivers and lakes in that drainage isn't solving any problems besides how pike will get their next meal. Chinook and coho in the Susitna drainage are also heavily impacted by pike predation. We also have Representative Chenault joining us. I would like to bring that fact to light and do everything I can to secure more funding or any additional resources that the Department of Fish and Game may require to fully address the eradication and suppression of pike in that drainage so that we can restore these stocks to a healthy status. As you will see in the presentation, the department has conducted active netting programs of pike in the Susitna drainage, but I believe they would be able to do more with more support from the legislature. The department will provide two very useful department did provide two very useful documents covering as well as the efforts to suppress those pike. I would point the members to those. One is the 55-page document titled Shell Lake Sockeye Salmon Progress Report, and the other is the one-page document titled Chilatna Lake Northern Pike Suppression Project. I believe it's important to note that in the one-page document, the department notes that it is estimated that the elimination of 958 northern pike in the Chilatna Lake will result in 13,229 additional sockeye returning throughout what would have been the seven-year life cycle of those pike. This is an estimate, but with that number, it's actually very staggering how the removal of pike can so drastically increase the amount of returning salmon to a system. We'll save that discussion for later, however. Without further delay, I'd like to ask the department to come forward and begin their presentation. Online, we have Christine Dunker, the Regional Invasive Species Coordinator, Division of Sportfish, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. She will be assisted in the slides in the room by Morgan Foss, Legislative Liaison, Department of Fish and Game. We also have, let me make sure we have, no, I don't see Charlie Swanton on the phone. There he is. It says on the phone, sorry. We have Charlie Swanton here with us, and we also have Scott Kelly here with us. And on the phone also we have Tom Brookover from the Department of Fish and Game. So, with that, if you would please identify yourself, your affiliation for the record, and begin with the presentation. I want to add one more thing. For the sake of time, I'm going to ask committee members to hold their questions to the end of the presentation. Thank you.
Chair, this is Tom Brookover. Can you and the committee hear me okay?
We can hear you fine. Thank you.
Thank you. So, for those in attendance, I'm the division director for Sportfish Division, Base 10 Anchorage. With me is Christine Duncker. Christine, by way of introduction, is a fishery biologist. She's also based here in Anchorage. She is in charge of our South Central Alaska invasive pike program. She'll be presenting an overview of invasive pike in South Central Alaska. And we understand the interest in how pike may be impacting sockeye salmon in the Susitna drainage. We've included information in the presentation to that effect, information that's available to us. And as you mentioned, Madam Chair, there's also two additional documents that the department's provided as well. We're also prepared to answer questions the committee may have after the presentation on invasive pike specific to sockeye and specific to any other species of interest as well. Director Scott Kelly with Commercial Fisheries Division is in the room, I believe. He and I are both available to answer questions the committee may have. I just wanted to point out that as our expert on northern pike, Christine may not be as familiar with some of the, you know, the salmon stock assessment projects or the more management-related questions or policy-related questions. But Scott and I will be happy to tag-team any types of questions like that. And I think with that, I'll turn it over to Christine. Morgan's going to run the slideshow, I believe, and Christine can take it away.
Thank you. Thank you, and I thank you in advance for that.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, for the record, my name is Christine Dunker, and I coordinate the invasive ocean pike program for the Sportfish Division in our South Central region. Thank you very much for the opportunity today to provide information on our recent northern pike control work. Advance. I'll begin with just a little bit of background on northern pike. First, northern pike are predatory fish that really thrive in shallow, weedy, low-flow habitats that look a lot like what's pictured here. And in these habitats, pike are at the top of the food chain. And they can be significant predators of salmonids and other species that also use this habitat.
Excuse me for one moment. Are you on a speakerphone?
Madam Chair, yes, I am on a speakerphone.
Can you use a handset? It seems to come through a little clearer for the committee.
Yes, Madam Chair, one moment as we figure out how to reset that up.
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand what you said.
Madam Chair, we'll have to call back in if the committee chooses to do that.
Well, we can hear you. We were just having some difficulty with Kristen.
Okay. Madam Chair, I will try to speak up, and if you still cannot hear me, please let me know, and we will call back.
Perfect. Thank you.
So, northern pike are opportunistic ambush predators. They'll eat everything from frogs to ducklings to mice to invertebrates, and even each other. But studies have shown that if soft-rayed fish like juvenile salmon are available, they're going to be targeted first. The feeding strategy of pike is to hide in weedy areas and wait until prey swims by, at which point they quickly dart out to capture it. Advance. This striking behavior makes them a really popular sport fish. But there is a negative side to this when pike become established in waters that they are not native to. And this has certainly been the case here in Alaska. However, the situation here is complex because pike are a native species to most of the state. The hatched area shows where pike are native, The solid red areas show where they are not and have been introduced. Animate. And in these areas, northern pike are an invasive species. Advance. By definition, an invasive species is a species that is both non-native and harmful in some capacity, generally causing ecological, economic, or human health impacts. Non-native pike certainly have the capacity to cause ecological and economic harm. Advance. And this is because, as a top predator, pike can potentially eliminate entire populations of fulmonids when pike are introduced to important fulmonid rearing habitats. And very quickly, Madam Chair, can you tell me what slide you are on?
They're not numbered. We are on the one with the fish with his belly cut open.
Okay, thank you very much. That's where we're supposed to be. However, our research in Alaska suggests that the level of impact pike have on fulmonid populations is tied to habitat. For instance, in waters that provide excellent habitat conditions for pike, so these are areas that are shallow, weedy, slow-moving throughout the entire area, pike will entirely overlap with rearing fulmonids like coho, chinook, rainbow trout, and sockeye that rear in shallow lakes. And predation levels on these species is typically very high. A good example of this would be Alexander Lake and Alexander Creek in Mississippi. Now, in waters that provide more mixed habitats, so for example, drainages with shallow vegetated sloughs and swampy areas, but also connected to areas of deep water or fast river channels, fulmonids can avoid predation in the areas that don't provide optimal pike habitat, and pike have a reduced impact on salmon populations. Or there's a better balance between pike predation and salmon production. A good example of this would be the Gushka River. And then in waters that are very deep, glacial, or high flow, without much submerged vegetation, pike don't really thrive in these waters and likely use them primarily as movement corridors, if at all. And in these areas, predation rates from fulmonids are very low, and this is more or less the case throughout the east side of the Sabetina Stream entering the Talkeetna Mountains. Advance. Invasive pike are widely distributed in south-central Alaska, from the Northern Cook Inlet Management Area down to the northern Kenai Peninsula. So on this map, drainages in red show where pike are well-established. The drainages in yellow do not have known pike populations, but we think these areas are vulnerable because they provide ideal habitat conditions for pike. We've now confirmed them in well over 120 individual water bodies associated with these drainages. Animate. However, over the last decade, we've been steadily chipping away at this problem, and to date, we have successfully eradicated pike from 6 in Anchorage and the Kenai Peninsula, as well as a series of ponds in Yakutat using the fish pesticide Rotenone. Yeah. So what is Rotenone? Rotenone is a highly regulated, restricted-use pesticide for fisheries management. Morgan, please advance.
That's where we are on the Rotenone slide.
Okay, we're seeing a video delay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Rotenone is naturally derived from tropical bean plants, and it's been used by indigenous cultures to collect fish for food for centuries and for fisheries management purposes for the last 90 years or so. Rotenone is lethal to fish because it is rapidly absorbed into the bloodstream through the gills, where it inhibits oxygen uptake, but it is not harmful for birds or mammals at the low concentrations used by fishery managers. Rotenone does not persist long-term in the environment, does not enter groundwater, and it degrades entirely. And it's used at extremely low concentrations, so once it's in the water, it is not harmful to people near the treatment areas. Currently, rotenone is the most feasible and proven method for eradication of pike populations. Advance. However, before we can proceed with any rotenone treatments, there are a number of permits and approvals we need to acquire. It generally takes well over a year to permit these projects. We usually begin with a public scoping process and host public meetings. And then for each treatment, we need to obtain a State of Alaska DEC pesticide use permit, which involves advertising in newspapers and holding a 30-day public comment period. To date, all of our rotenone projects have been fully funded with grants, which I will speak to more about in a bit, but this federal funding triggers the NEPA process. So for NEPA, we have to prepare an environmental assessment document, and this EA is also put out for public comment. And then the Fish and Wildlife Service waives the EA with those public comments, and either issues us what's called a finding of no significant impact, or a FONSI, or requests an environmental impact statement. But to date, all of our projects have been issued that FONSI. In addition, there are additional DNR and fish and game permits, but the last piece we need is Alaska Board of Fisheries approval to use Rotnome for each individual project. Along with the permitting, there's an extensive field process to follow for each of these projects, and I'm not going to get into the details of each of these steps, but the point here is that there's a lot of planning, data collection, and assessment work for each of these projects, and they generally take multiple years to complete. So these projects are very extensive from start to finish, and Rotnome is not the right tool for all water bodies, especially areas that are really spatially extensive or highly interconnected, such as the Susitna River drainage, which again I'll speak to you more about in a few moments. So along with weighing the feasibility of conducting a successful Rotnome treatment, we have a process for prioritizing where we focus our efforts of funding for pike eradication projects within the Division of Sportfish. And this stems from our Sportfish Division strategic plan, as well as the management plan that we have for northern pike in South Central Alaska. Animate. But the bottom line is that we are trying to target our work where we will have the most success containing this problem and preventing pike from spreading to other waters. Advance. And this is pretty much what all of our northern pike eradication projects that we've conducted to date were meant to do. Advance. But as an example, I would just like to briefly highlight our largest and most extensive project to date, which is currently wrapping up on the Kenai Peninsula. This is our Soldotna Creek pike eradication project. Soldotna Creek is a tributary to the Kenai River. And again, this project was really about prevention. While the Kenai River itself is not the right habitat for pike to thrive in, we were very concerned that pike temporarily moving through the Kenai River could access and establish in other vulnerable Kenai tributaries like the Moose River, where up to 40% of the Kenai River's coho salmon production occurs. So this project involved breaking the Soldotna Creek drainage into two sections, animate, and systematically treating these two sections over the course of 4 years. The first section we treated in October of 2014, animate, did not have any other fish left other than pike. The second section, animate, did still have native fish, and a significant part of this project involved rescuing as many of these as we could to reestablish populations in the first treatment area. Advance. This project was by far the most complicated series of Rotnome treatments we've completed. It involved applying Rotnome in a variety of ways, including with a helicopter. The treatments began in 2014, and they finished up last summer. In total, we treated just shy of 500 surface acres of lakes, about 150 acres of wetlands, over 20 miles of Soldotna Creek and its tributary streams. Advance. Throughout the entire process, we've been monitoring the treated lakes to make sure the pike are gone with gill net and eDNA assessments, where we actually look for evidence of pike DNA in water samples. We're still finalizing these evaluations. It currently looks like the treatments were successful. Advance. And one of the best parts of this project has been our opportunity to restore the native fish populations throughout the Soldotna Creek drainage lakes. In 2015, between our treatment years, we spent the open water season catching as many native fish as we could from the section of the drainage we had not yet treated, animate, and stocked them into the areas that we had treated, animate, and at that point, we knew no longer had any more live pike. In total, animate, we have relocated over 91,000 native fish to jumpstart recovery of the native fish population. People are now fishing in these lakes again and even reporting seeing loons successfully nest for the first time in many years. Advance. And with the conclusion of the Soldotna Creek project, we are very close to eradicating pike from all Kenai Peninsula waters where we have known confirmed pike populations. Except for a series of 8 small closed lakes, animate, along Choate Road south of Soldotna. And this is our last known holdout for pike on the Kenai Peninsula. These are all relatively small lakes, and we hope to be treating them this coming fall. Our largest concern is that this project is very close to Anajamas waters, animate, and animate once more. It would be really easy for these lakes to serve as an accessible source of pike that could be used to refeed other waters on the Kenai. And that is really what we are trying to prevent with this work. Okay. And if we are successful with these treatments, and barring any new pike discoveries on the Kenai Peninsula, the Kenai could be pike-free for the first time in 4 decades, which is a huge milestone and not typically how invasive species stories tend to end. But if this continues to be the case, the focus of our Sportfish Division Invasive Northern Pike Program will transition from pike eradication on the Kenai Peninsula and anchorage areas to containment, eradication where possible, and pike suppression in the Matthew Valley and the west side of Cook Inlet. This area, and particularly the Susitna River drainage, is a very different situation than the Kenai Peninsula, where we've had a lot of eradication success because of how interconnected that drainage is. The Susitna River watershed is comparable to the size of the state of Indiana. So Rotenone treatments would not provide for long-term eradication in connected waters, because pike will eventually find their way back. The most effective thing we can do is contain this problem and prevent pike from spreading to other waters. Prevention for any invasive species is the most efficient solution. And effective public outreach and education on this topic is critical, and we will be ramping up these efforts in the valley. We will also be proactively surveying waters for early detection and confirmation of pike distribution. We will eradicate pike populations where it is feasible and a high priority to do so, and we will suppress pike populations as well to benefit salmon productivity. And for several years now, we have been actively engaged in a pike suppression program in Alexander Creek, which again is a Susitna River tributary. We started this project in 2011. This is not an eradication program because the system is too interconnected for rotenone treatments to successfully eradicate the pike, but we are trying to reduce the abundance of the pike in this area. So prior to 2000, Alexander Creek was one of the most productive Chinook salmon rivers in South Central Alaska. Northern pike were introduced to Alexander Lake in the 1960s, animate. But it took a few decades for pike to disperse throughout the 40-mile river corridor and established in the lower river, animate, where they were first discovered in this area in the late 1990s. Following the establishment of pike in the lower river, Chinook numbers declined below escapement, animate. And this was happening at a time when other nearby Chinook populations were thriving, which was strong correlative evidence to us that the Chinook declines in Alexander Creek were related to the northern pike. Today, the Chinook salmon fishery on Alexander Creek is closed, as are many businesses that once serviced that fishery. It's estimated that the economic loss from this specific scenario was in the multiple millions of dollars. So in response, we have been implementing this Northern Pike Suppression Program to try and increase Chinook salmon productivity in the system. Each May, during the pike spring season, we gillnet about 60 side channel sloughs of Alexander Creek until we are no longer consistently catching pike in them. Our goal is to drive down pike numbers to increase the chances of survival for juvenile salmonids rearing in the system. We plan to continue this effort annually. To date, we've removed over 19,000 pike through this project, another couple thousand in some preliminary work. And in addition to netting, our field crews conduct minnow trap surveys to assess juvenile salmonid populations, and we're also looking at stomach contents of pike throughout the creek. And so far, we're seeing some encouraging results. Again, when we first started this project in 2011, we were only seeing juvenile salmonids in the lowest section of Alexander Creek. However, over the last few years, we have documented juvenile salmonids from minnow traps and pike stomachs further and further upstream. Currently, juvenile salmonids, including Chinook, are now found again in all river sections all the way up to Alexander Lake. And we have also seen an increasing trend in the number of adult Chinook salmon returning to Alexander Creek animate, and as well to their former spawning grounds in the system. These are favorable signs that we are making progress with this project, and we will be continuing this effort annually. In addition to the efforts on Alexander Creek, we do net the Deshka River every few years to thin the pike population in the lower sloughs of the river. Also, our Commercial Fisheries Division and the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association have active pike suppression programs in lakes and lake outlets in the Yetna River drainage. These are Shell, Chelatna, Whiskey, and Hewitt lakes. These projects have a goal of increasing survival of out-migrating sockeye smolts. These projects have also included studies of pike diets, and their data show that when the sockeye are out-migrating from these lakes, pike diets are comprised mostly of sockeye, and these pike suppression projects are really trying to mitigate this. Collectively, there are many organizations working on the invasive pike problem, both the sport and commercial fisheries divisions within Fish and Game, the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association, the U.S. Geological Survey, the University of Alaska and Fairbanks, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Tyonet Tribal Conservation District, among other partners. And we are collectively very much still learning about the impacts that pike have on different salmon populations. The best information we currently have is that this story is complex, and the severity of impact varies by individual lake and river system. So while, as you've seen in this presentation, pike are most certainly problematic in South Central Alaska, they are likely one of many factors contributing to salmon population dynamics in the system and elsewhere. Advance. And as I've mentioned, within the ADF&G Sport Fish Division program that I oversee, we prioritize our projects based on where we expect pike are, or in the case of prevention, could be that primary factor. So now as we transition our program within the Sport Fish Division to the Northern Cook Inlet Management Area, we are also looking ahead at our first pike eradication project in the Matsu. We're actively seeking funding for pike eradication in Anderson and Kings Lakes in the Cottonwood Creek Drainage near Wasilla. We also foresee treating Lower Fire Lake and Eagle River with rotenone in the near future to remove its pike population. Both of these projects would aid the prevention of pike from spreading via kinetic arm into vulnerable waters like the Jim Creek drainage. We also will be conducting an initial assessment this summer to begin a new pike suppression program in the 3-mile drainage on the west side of Cook Inlet. And we've just hired a new invasive species biologist based in Palmer to lead these efforts. He'll be initiating a standardized survey effort to clarify pike distribution in the Matsu and facilitate planning of future pike control efforts in the region. Advance. So that's what we have accomplished so far and where we're headed from here. To date, not counting the salaries of staff who permanently work on these projects, these efforts within the Division of Sport Fish have cost approximately $3.8 million so far. We are very grateful for the support of our partners and funding agencies, particularly the Alaska Sustainable Salmon Fund. The vast majority of work to date has been funded through Sustainable Salmon Fund grants, which originate through NOAA. They've collectively contributed approximately $3.4 million in support to ADF&G, both, I believe, in the Divisions of Sport Fish and Commercial Fisheries, as well as the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association for the corrective pike suppression and eradication work we've conducted. And we're also very appreciative of funding that we received from the legislature in 2011 to fund our Alexander Creek pike suppression efforts. We're provided about $130,000 each year for this effort, and currently this allotment is entirely funding that suppression program. So with that, thank you again for the opportunity to provide this information, and please let me know if you have any questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was a very informative presentation, and we certainly appreciate it. I have a couple questions. It appears in light of this presentation that pike are clearly a significant predator of sockeye, coho, and Chinook salmon in the Susitna drainage. Is that a fairly accurate statement?
Madam Chair, it is. The level of impact and severity of impact, we think, is somewhat similar or river system dependent. In areas that there's deep water locations for, you know, crayfish to hide from pike, in other words, areas where pike would not be as prevalent, we don't think that those impacts are as great. But when there is complete habitat overlap and crayfish don't have anywhere to get away and avoid them, our data have shown they can eliminate populations.
So I'm presuming that could be a very real contributor to the stock of yield concern in that area as well, then. I have a question for Scott Kelly, if he would come forward. Do you have some questions, Representative? Okay. I'm looking at and I'm listening. That was a pretty thorough presentation, and I certainly appreciate it and appreciate the effort that it took to accommodate this committee. And this, some of my questions were partially answered, but I know that they were talking about the projects that were ongoing and that they were funded by Dingell Johnson funding, which would indicate that it pertains mostly to sport fish areas. So I guess my question that I really want to get on the record is, wouldn't it be very helpful to the department if the legislature and the state stepped up to help with additional funding for the eradication of these in the commercial areas as well?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Scott Kelly. I'm the Director of Commercial Fisheries Division. My answer to that would be simply yes. Additional funding would be welcomed, could certainly be utilized, and of course I'm not the person who would direct those funds, but we'd certainly work as a department, probably with Ms. Dunker's program specifically, and yes.
Well, it appears with your huge success on the Kenai Peninsula, that would only be a win-win deal if you got some additional funding for that. I will go to Representative Newman, so we're on a limited amount of time, and I don't want to...
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is all in my backyard, and I spent lots of time on these lakes. I appreciate it. Went down and captured pike on the Alexander Creek and stuff, very familiar with it. My good friend Dave Rutz started this program. Actually, the funding came from funding that I was able to get from capital budget funding to do the Alexander. Or do you feel that they may be stunted because of the environment?
Representative Newman, are you referring to the size of the smolt and the pike stomachs, or the size of the pike that were dissecting?
The size of the smolt.
It's hard to say. I don't believe we have recognized any substantial change in size shift of the prey. We have noticed the pike themselves decreasing in size over time, but I don't believe we have anything similar to say about the actual size of the salmonid prey at all.
Follow up.
Okay.
With that too, and you're specializing in this, I get it.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, Alexander Lake, and you've referenced being out there. It is very, very, it's a very complex system. When you fly over it, it's sort of akin to flying over the Everglades. All the floating bogs and the expanse of wetland area makes rote known very difficult to work in the way that it would in a more closed lake system. It'd be very easy for pike to hide from it. A pike can detect rote known, but it takes a little bit of time for it to work, and so they can detect that stress and try to get away from it. So likely they would shoot under those floating bogs and get into areas where the rote known wouldn't penetrate as well. And so while it would likely result in high mortality of pike, it would not be a complete kill in a system as complex as that. It would be a large, large treatment, a very expensive endeavor, and the bottom line is that pike will eventually make their way back up into the lake via Alexander Creek, so that entire system would have to be treated. And all of the work we put into the suppression efforts to increase the salmonid productivity over the last several years, we'd be undertaking a very large rescue effort for those fish. You know, there could potentially be some mortality there as well. So it's just going to be a highly complex eradication program that doesn't have a high likelihood of success in eradicating the pike.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to point out, this is an interesting slide, you know, of the... The one where it's cooking in the affected streams in red and vulnerable parts in the Kenai Peninsula. And I'd just like to note, Madam Chair, we look at a lot of these tributaries, but the only money that went into trying to help this project was capital dollars, you know, that I was able to secure to be able to put in this several years ago. And also when we're thanking, glad that they did point out the Dingell Johnson funds, because when we thank all the people on the bottom here who funded this, it's sportsmen and women of Alaska, you know, who purchase fishing licenses, at a lot of that, and sporting goods that do this too. We can't forget the people. I'm glad you're addressing this, Madam Chair, because it just seems Cook Inlet. I'm glad to see a chair that's wanting to step up and help us do this too and work with them. You can see the amount of money that's going in there compared to statewide going on in Matsu. where right. we have 8 of 12 stocks of concern.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Newman. And once again, I want to thank the department and for all the work that went into this. And, you know, I have a quick question. On the in relation to the invasive species of Elodia, does that contribute to the habitat for the pike at all?
Madam Chair, we have not conducted any specific studies, and the DNR, actually, who has management authority for Elodia, has not yet conducted any studies to truly measure that association. Elodia certainly has the capacity to change habitat, to slow down water flow, potentially decreasing favorable habitat conditions for salmon spawning and increasing habitat conditions for pike spawning. So one could venture that this is not a good thing, but we have quantitative data to really say for certain what this relationship is. That is an area of needed research.
Thank you. Thank you. Director Kelly, you had a possibly a response as well. Did you? No. Okay.
Ms. Dunker covered it very well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Christ-Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really exciting to see the progress from the department, and this is all keen interest to me, particularly Elodia and the notion of nipping it in the bud, almost literally. And I had just a quick question about rotenone on the slide that describes the step-by-step process. The last bullet is restore the fishery, and I don't mean for any critical or negative connotation to be in this question because I'm really supportive of all of this, but was curious if you or Ms. Dunker could speak to that a little bit more, in particular how restoration of, I mean, if rotenone kills the fish in a watershed, is there a process to reestablish salmon runs, given that presumably all the smolt also die? Could you speak to that a little bit as well?
Sure. Through the chair, yes. So this varies very much by individual project area and treatment. So for, you know, in a small closed stock lake, like the department, that's simple. You know, we can restart with hatchery fish. But most of our projects recently have been in areas that benefit wild fish. And so we have a variety of ways of doing this. First and foremost, if we're treating in an open system, we are neutralizing the rotenone that leaves the actual treatment area. So, sporadically, if there are salmon or trout or other species downstream of the treatment area, we are neutralizing the rotenone. You can do that by applying potassium permanganate, and there is no effect on those species downstream. However, if native fish are present, we do what we can to rescue as many of those as possible. We did a treatment from Stormy Lake back in 2010. That lake still had native arctic char and some other species there prior to the treatment, and we spent the preceding months trying to remove as many as we could. We held some in net pens. We also collected egg takes and did in the broodstock and raised them in our hatchery to ensure that genetics were preserved. And then after the rotenone had degraded entirely, and we'd measured that through water testing and various other methods, we were able to put those fish back to just our populations, and that's currently being assessed, and the char and other native fish are doing quite well. With the Philbotna Creek project that I highlighted, you know, we were in a unique situation there that we had part of the treatment area did not have anything, not even a stickleback, this pike, and then the second part of the treatment area that did have quite a few native fish, and that's why we took a year in between to relocate those as much as we could and try to really mitigate in that system, and again, further mitigated that by neutralizing the rotenone downstream of the treatment area.
Thank you. And just a follow-up, if I may, and maybe a question for you, Madam Chair. I'm just in terms of the agenda, is there a further presentation from ADF&G on Elodia? Or this is
no, not at this time.
May I ask a question about Elodia?
Certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was interested in terms of Elodia specifically. I've read some of the work of Toby Schwarr at ICER about Elodia and the potentially anticipated economic costs of Elodia if not eradicated, if it spreads in vectors, as is reasonably anticipated, as has already happened. And I was interested if the department could speak a little bit more to its Elodia eradication efforts right now, and also for the extent that you do have funding to do it, where that money is coming from, and whether it's possible for additional Dingell Johnson money to go into Elodia eradication.
Through the chair, this particular question would best be addressed to the Department of Natural Resources, who have management authority over the Elodea issue. The Department of Fish and Game, we're not in charge of these projects. We provide support. We do assist with the eradication work, but it is ultimately developed and funded, permitted, and all through the Department of Natural Resources. That said, you know, we have assisted with some herbicide treatments that the DNR has taken the lead on, and that's an ongoing areas of it, the Kenai Peninsula and the Anchorage Bowl, as well as, I believe, in Fairbanks. It's an ongoing process. The treatments work a little differently than our pike treatments do. And the funding has come from a wide array of sources, as I understand it, but I do believe the DNR could speak to that particular piece in a little bit more detail than I'm able to.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm basically what I'm hearing is sort of Elodea's DNR's bailiwick, although ADF&G has a lot of expertise and, you know, wants to collaborate. My understanding is DNR basically has no money to really meaningfully work on the Elodea issue, and I'm wondering, given that there seems to be some sort of agency agency separation, whether ADF&G, it's ever been discussed or contemplated about ADF&G directing Dingell Johnson money to work hand in hand with DNR to eradicate Elodea. And that might be a question for you, Mr. Kelly, or someone who works in the department's budget.
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, no, that hasn't crossed my desk, and I think Ms. Dunker is the best to answer that question. Okay. And Director Brookover, who also is the main point of contact for DJ funding, and I defer to him on that. Madam Chair.
Director
Brookover. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Chris Tompkins has it correctly. DNR has the authority to deal with invasive aquatic plants in freshwater. Our focus is on aquatic invasive fish. I wanted to point out, though, in this line of questions, that there's another staff member that we have as a statewide invasive species coordinator within Sport Fish Division who's not present. That's Tammy Davis, and some of you may have heard of her. Tammy's in charge of coordinating our statewide invasive species program, whereas Christine is in charge of specifically our pike program in South Central. Tammy Davis works closely with counterparts in DNR in coordinating a myriad of invasive species efforts that cross jurisdictional lines, as does Chrissy. We have an MOU with DNR that talks about you know, coordination of duties, and we've actively helped DNR, as Christine mentioned, with specific Elodea eradication projects. With respect to the use of DJ funds, you know, DJ funds could conceivably be applied to Elodea suppression or eradication efforts where there's a clear nexus with sport fish. The use of DJ funds is constrained to projects that directly benefit anglers. And with Elodea, there are a lot of different types of impacts that can occur from its onset. It can certainly impact fisheries, but it can also impact water intakes and development projects and even transportation. So the impacts to Elodea are broad. There's potentially, in any case, you know, a number of different agencies that would be brought to bear on the issue. Where there is a clear nexus with sport fish, especially if it's, you know, an important or priority fishery, we could certainly consider allocating some of our DJ funds to that. Our DJ funds are currently fully allocated, so to do that would just, you know, that would require maybe something else being reduced or cut. Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just a comment, if I may.
Certainly.
That's really helpful, and I just want to reiterate how grateful I am for the department's work on Northern Pike, Elodea. We got a little DVEC situation in Sitka, and I know the department has done its very best with available resources there, and just glad we've got these public servants working on the problem.
Right. You know, I do have one thing that I want to ask you, because I can't hardly believe it. In the Shell Lake Sockeye Salmon Progress Report that was provided to this committee, it appears, if I'm reading this correctly, that in 2007, 80,600 smolt were released, and 21,000, a little more than 21,000 returned? Or, excuse me, escaped? There was 80,000 released, and 21,000 actually made it out of the lake, which tells me those pike are pretty ding-dong hungry. Is that correct? Am I reading this correctly?
Madam Chair, I believe you are, yes. I think you're looking at figure 2 on page 5 of the Shell Lake Sockeye Salmon Progress Report?
Correct.
Yeah. Now, it is survival rates from pre-smolt fall stocking to spring smolt stocking do vary quite a bit. But clearly, there's a pike nexus here, as we've all determined, and they do predate on salmonids heavily.
That's unbelievable. Unbelievable. are there any other questions from this committee? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On to your point, you know, about the lack of escapement of salmon coming out of it, that's why I asked, you know, we're talking to these folks a lot. If you don't have spawners coming in, everybody loses. You have to have the amount of spawners. And so to counteract the amount of spawners that are not making it out or surviving in the freshwater and having more escapement into there, so you have more fry to counteract that. And it was supported by that, I think, by our both board fish members. And I think what they mean is trying to hit to the middle range of the escapement goals and stuff to make sure that that happens. But thank you, Madam Chair, for that observation.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Kelly. I appreciate it. Deputy Commissioner Swanton, we appreciate you taking your time to come. Morgan, thank you for helping facilitate this. And I want to thank Christine Dunker and Mr. Brookover. That would be Director Brookover. Thank you for your time and the excellent presentation. And with that, I would like to say we have not yet scheduled any committee hearings for next week. If we do so, I will notify the committee by email, and we will adjourn at 10:50.